And now a short scene to take us into our talk.
So, I'm afraid your moment has come.
Not so fast, Miss Scarlet. I do have a secret or two.
Oh, yeah, such as?
The game's up, Scarlet. There are no more bullets left in that gun.
Come on, you don't think I'm going to fall for that old trick.
It's not a trick. There was one shot at Mr. Body in the study, two for the chandelier, two at the lounge door, and one for the singing telegram.
That's not six.
One plus two plus two plus one.
Uh-uh. There was only one shot that got the chandelier. That's one plus two plus one plus one.
Even if you were right, that would be one plus one plus two plus one, not one plus two plus one plus one.
Okay, fine. One plus two plus one. Shut up! Point is, there's one bullet left in this gun, and guess who's going to get it?
Oh! I'm only a guest.
Where's the chief?
Ah, Wadsworth. Well done.
I did warn you, my dear. Mr. Hoover is an expert on Armageddon.
Wadsworth, don't hit me if you're trying to shoot you.
Frankly, Scarlet, I don't give a damn. As I was trying to tell you, there are no bullets left in this gun, you see? One plus two. Plus one.
Plus two plus one is...
So...
Okay, even though we're running late, people said they wanted the joke, so here it comes. There was a minister that decided to use visual aids to emphasize a point. So he started his sermon by showing four jars. The first one was filled with alcohol. The second one was filled with smoke. The third one was filled with chocolate syrup. And the fourth one was filled with soil. Then he placed a worm in each jar. And at the end of the talk, he again displayed the jars. In the jar with alcohol, the worm was dead. The worms in the jars with smoke and chocolate syrup also were dead. But the worm in the jar with the soil was alive. And the minister held the four jars in the air and asked, "Do you know what this shows?" And a woman in the congregation jumped up and said, "Yeah, you drink, smoke, and eat chocolate, you won't get worms." Well, that joke, silly as it may be, it's an appropriate opening for our talk today because our topic is clueless. Clueless is not a nice word. If a crime has been committed and there's not a single clue to go on, that means there is little or no chance to solve the crime. And clueless should not be confused with innocence. If you call someone innocent, it's a compliment. If you call someone or describe someone as clueless, it usually is a put down and a harsh one at that. I remember back in high school, in biology class, Brother Richard asked a student a question. And after 30 seconds of silence, in response to the question, Brother Richard just sighed and said, "He doesn't have a clue." Well, I must admit that since that student went on to fail biology and five other subjects that semester, Brother Richard may have had a point. I also remember one of my teenage loves criticizing me by telling me about five or six things that were wrong with me. And so I asked her, "Why do I get the feeling that you're breaking up with me?" And she answered, "What was your first clue?" Clues are very important. There are some things that don't use clues, like memorizing multiplication tables or having your birthday, on the same day every year. But for most of us, when it comes to figuring out what life is all about, we pretty much rely upon and use clues to get there. Growing up, most of you may very well have played the game clue. The game was invented in Great Britain in 1949. In 1985, Hollywood made a movie out of the board game. And so that video at the beginning was a clip from the movie. It was one of the endings. The movie was deadpanned by the critics. Me, I thought it was funny, entertaining, and actually kind of brilliant. It was a whodunit story with a humorous twist. But what made the movie truly unique is that it featured not one, but three different and very distinct endings. And what was really cool about it is that which ending any particular moviegoer saw depended on the theater in which they watched the movie, because different theaters showed three different endings, and the endings varied randomly. So if you saw the movie at an AMC theater in Mount Prospect, it likely would be a different ending than if you saw it at an AMC theater in Kane County. In each version of the movie, the conclusion was a logical manifestation of thoughts based upon the facts. In each version, the scenes, the actions, and the dialogues of the film were identical. The clues leading up to the different endings were identical. And in each version, the thoughts leading up to any given conclusion were shared logically. And each ending was plausible. Each ending made sense. So let's just pause for a moment to understand a very human dynamic. We can witness the situations that provide us with the very same clues and come away with very different interpretations and conclusions. Is it any wonder that we can look at issues such as abortion, immigration, social justice, global warming, healthcare, and come away with very different perspectives? And from my perspective and from your perspective, we easily can look at people holding a different perspective and call them clueless. This happens not only with political issues. The same process takes place in our relationships. It determines how we react in response to a word or a frown or a smile. It's something that affects our physical health. It definitely affects our lifestyle, our prosperity, and whether we think in terms of lack or abundance. And most significantly, it determines where you are on that important spectrum of being a person that has some sense of self-worth and self-esteem, or a person of shame. So the movie beautifully illustrated a concept. Change your thoughts. Change your life. And while the purpose of the movie was to determine who committed a murder, much of our own journey is focused on looking at the clues that come at us and trying to figure out what life is all about and why we are here. The what of things is usually pretty clear. The how and the why are more elusive. As we contemplate why things happen and how we are to respond, we come up with thoughts to fill in blanks and create stories. And we develop subplots to make our experiences make sense and to justify the endings. And sometimes people around us dictate and suggest what our thinking should be, and what stories we should be creating. And so often we buy into them. We use those stories that we invent to not only justify past events, but to shape future expectations and our outlooks on life. Do you want to know a basic elementary difference in approach between the Hebrew scriptures and the Christian scriptures? The Hebrew scriptures' emphasis and focus is on consequences. The Christian scriptures, through the Christ, are all about possibilities. The difference between victims and heroes in life is simply the nature of their thinking. When a crisis occurs, a victim might get stuck thinking, oh, woe is me. A hero, on the other hand, may initially feel that way, but soon shifts to thinking, what is mine to do? Or even, this is my moment. I am being called. We all have experiences in our lives that have been difficult and painful. And the stories we choose to create about those experiences are what shape our lives and define us. Being defined by our thinking is an age-old concept. Proverbs 23:7 says, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. Henry Ford once said, whether you think you can or you think you can't, you're right. And as children, we listened to the story of the little engine that could, the little engine that just kept affirming over and over again, I think I can, I think I can, I think I can. I want to share with you the words of Novak Djokovic after he came back and won the French Open this year after it really, really looked like he was going to be a loser. And this is a clip from the Daily Herald, and these are his words. There's always two choices inside. There's one telling you you can't do it, that it's done, that it's finished. That voice was pretty strong after I lost that second set. So I felt that it was time for me to actually vocalize the other voice and try to suppress the one that was saying, I can't make it. I told myself I can do it, encouraged myself. I strongly started to repeat that inside of my mind, tried to live it with my entire being. We are truth seekers. But the truth is that there's the truth, and then there's the truth. I know. It sounds like a bunch of hogwash, a lot of double talk, right? What I'm trying to say is that there is your truth based on your personal lens and filters. And then there is the truth, the law that supposedly we all are pursuing. It's the underlying energy of absolutely all that we are and everything that is. And I will share another truth with you. As human beings, we're at the top of the rung, the top of the heap. We have been gifted with very high intellects and powers of reason. And I have no doubt that we are to take the clues that we find and ultimately figure it out until there is no upper and lower realm, no distinction between heaven and earth. It is very basic, but we have to know beyond a shadow of a doubt that just like the opening video, that 1 + 2 + 2 + 1 = 5. I know. It really equals 6. I just wanted to see if you were paying attention. But there are times that we just don't know. There are times we truly are unsure. We are told that we need surgery, but we are scared. There are times we get stuck not knowing if we should play it safe according to everything that has ever been told to us, or if we should venture out and venture forth. And there are times when we wonder, can we believe the words of someone who tells us, I love you? And there are times when we want to say, I love you to someone else, but we're afraid because we don't know how it will be received. And there are times when we hear a call to move forward and to grow, but our sense of shame is telling us, that's a really bad idea. And by the way, this thing called shame is more infectious and contagious than any coronavirus ever was. Every one of us has dealt with, is dealing with, or will deal with shame at some point in our journeys. And let me tell you this, shame is not some dead thing. Shame is alive. It's a very powerful negative energy that has only one purpose, not to kill you physically, but to destroy you. A fate much worse than death. And how does it go about this? By trying to make you as clueless as possible. Have you ever prayed, please, Lord, give me a sign? I know I have many times in my life. I'd look up at the sky looking for I don't know what, the clouds to turn red or the birds to fly upside down. I don't know. Something dramatic. In the Gospel of Matthew, the Pharisees and the Sadducees come to Jesus and they say, Teacher, we wish to see a sign from you. But they really weren't looking for a sign. They were just trying to bring him down, to humiliate him, and to bring him to shame. But Jesus turned it around. He says to them, an evil and unfaithful generation seeks a sign. In other words, you are so immersed in your mired consciousness, you hold yourselves in such low self-esteem that you don't see a way out. If we find ourselves being part of that generation, we sure as heck got a lot of help getting there. But whether we got pushed there or decided to go there on our own, staying there and saying no to our shame absolutely is a choice, our choice, nobody else's. But today, if you're looking for a sign or a clue of some sort, I've got something for you. For starters, let me be your sign. Let me be your sign. And I'm not saying that with any sense of ego or any pretense that I have all of the answers. Far from it, not at all. But I do have a suggestion, what direction you can take. And that is, if you're looking for a sign, there's no better place to look than within yourself. You know, it's really interesting. Our bodies know when there's something wrong. If we have a throbbing toothache, we don't need a dentist to tell us that there's something wrong. If you have a serious migraine, you feel it. And you don't need anybody to tell you that it incapacitates you. And if you're getting sharp, intense pains in your side, you know, or at least I hope you know, to get to a hospital before your appendix ruptures. And if you fall and shatter a bone, don't you really kind of know it's time to head for the ER? You want a real life-changing sign? Look at what's hurting you. Look at what you're ashamed of. Look at what is telling you, eating away at you. Look at what is destroying any sense of confidence. Look at what is making you afraid or causing you to second guess yourself. Look at what is burning away with you and just keeping you angry. Because you see, these are your clues. And you know why they're clues? Because they don't fit. That thing called shame may be telling you to wear them, that they are exactly what you deserve, that they define you, and that they are you. Like that negative voice that Novak Djokovic spoke about. You can't beat it. It will whisper in your ear that that's who you are. Shame will wail on, trying to convince you that the only way to dull the pain is to have that next cigarette, that next cupcake, that next drink, that next crappy relationship. And time after time, when we listen to that nonsense, we end up feeling bad once again, maybe even worse than we did before. Because there's this inner knowing that it doesn't fit. If you wear a size 8 shoe, try jamming your foot in a size 7 just for an hour. Shame is telling you that that is the way that it is, that you are supposed to be feeling that pain. And you know what makes shame so hurtful? It's precisely because you realize, to use the daily word from today, you realize it doesn't fit. Your soul knows it. Your soul knows it's not why we are here. Your soul understands its connection to the oneness. Your soul deep down gets it that we are intended to be free and happy and at peace. So anytime we allow shame to win out, we are slamming the door instead of opening the window to who and what we really are. And on a deep spiritual level, we know it. Just like our bodies know something's not right when we're running a fever of 104. And it's in that inner knowing that when we accept our shame and we surrender to anything less than our Christ essence, that we write a sad ending based not on spiritual clues, but on red herrings. The study of psychology looks at people who have had similar human experiences in order to predict how people will react. It's all about creating boxes and placing people into the slots. And it asks the question, what is the pattern? But spirituality, as in spirit, starts where psychology leaves off. It says, you are not ordained to live your life according to a pattern. Spirituality says, the hell with patterns. You write your story, and an appropriate ending will follow. And most importantly, spirit says, if you follow the clues of your heart, do not worry. If you fall, you will be caught. Spirituality, spirit says, failure isn't bad and it isn't permanent. And no matter what, you are precious. You are lovable, and therefore you are always loved. Can it be as simple as this? Change your thinking, change your life. The answer is yes, but don't take my word for it. We just have to remember to include God. As we review our thinking on a given topic or what we are feeling, we can ask ourselves, where's the God in this story? And of course, the method of this inquiry is prayer. The more that we look for God in our thoughts, in our stories, and in our lives, the more we discern the deeper meaning of our lives. If God is absent from our story, it's because we have written God out of the story. Just like the writers of the gospel, let's not just put God back into the story, but let's make God the story. Because if we do so, in so doing, Spirit will guide us. Our prayers are answered, and the way becomes clear. And we are no longer clueless, but inwardly and ultimately outwardly, surely we are directed to our highest good. And now let's take this to prayer and look for some more clues.